Latin is a language as dead can be. It killed the ancient Romans, and now it's killing me. Welcome to Handmade Humanity, a podcast that helps you in the lifelong pursuit of wisdom and virtue. Each week, we will explore classical literature and ideas, making them accessible to the average reader. There are no shortcuts, techniques, or methods that can substitute for judgment, dexterity, and care, because humanity is handmade. Welcome to another episode of Handmade Humanity. I'm Austin Hoffman, joined by Max Pointner. What are we going to be talking about today, Max?
Today, we are actually going to be talking about my favorite thing to teach, which is Latin. It's sort of this age-old vanguard of classical education and probably one of the stereotypes that pops up when people think, well, don't you just study Latin in a classical school? But today we're going to dive right in and talk about all of the reasons that we think Latin is really a transformative study and why there is a lot of reasons for studying Latin beyond just the typical, oh, you learn it so you can learn other Romance languages.
Right. I think Latin sometimes gets viewed as just this holdover, like, oh, you're just preserving it just because you can. And it's kind of this old element of the aristocracy. I was actually at the doctor's office the other day and I was talking to him and he asked me what I did. And it's like, yeah, well, I teach at a school. I teach humanities and logic and Latin. He's like, yeah, you know, in high school, I thought I was the smart one because I was going to be a doctor and I did Latin. Oh, that was a big mistake. Should have done Spanish. It's just like, that's kind of the view, right? Oh, why are you still doing this? Nobody speaks it. Therefore, it's useless. Well, today we hope to give some strong reasons, I hope, for still continuing this language. Latin is not dead. It just became immortal.
Who said that? Is that you?
I don't know I got it from somebody else. I don't know exactly who said it, but if something can die and still come back to life, I mean, that's a mark of immortality. So today we have a few different headings under which we've organized reasons to study Latin. We're going to go in good classical rhetorical order, as we spoke on the rhetoric show. So we're going to go with strong, weak, and then the strongest argument. So first of all, you should learn Latin because of its mind-ordering power. Its mind-ordering power. So maybe it will help to think about Latin as analogous to math. So oftentimes students, even if you get them in an algebra class, right? Even math falls victim to this criticism. When are we ever going to use this? And you're really tempted to reply, well, Johnny, maybe you won't use it, but I think Timmy's going to. But math, even if you don't break out your algebra 2 formulas in your career, that still shaped the way you think about the world. It still developed your mind to be able to comprehend things in number, to think about problems rationally and work through them towards a solution. Mm. Even if you don't use the same process, you still got the benefit of it. And you can think of Latin in the same way, that Latin is doing for your linguistic faculties what math is doing for your, I don't know the exact term, but your mathematical faculties.
I was just talking to a math teacher that goes to my church, and he loves seeing poetry in math. You know, when he teaches math, it's all, he's always just trying to see the beauty in it and how it cracks into the order of the universe. And he was telling this story recently about this poster he saw at his high school where it had all of the equations that you typically learn in a high school math education. And under each equations, it listed all the scenarios in which in a career you might have to use that, right? So mechanical engineers would use these formulas. Chemical engineers would use these formulas. And he talked about looking at this poster and just despising it, right? Because it reduced math to just this stepping stone from one subject to another subject. And, you know, he talked about how we started talking about Leonard Bernstein and how Bernstein saw math as this fabric of the universe that music tapped into. And he said, the problem is it's really hard to quote Leonard Bernstein to, you know, most high school math students who are just there because they have to be there. But I think Latin is sort of the same way, right? Mm-hmm. If we can see Latin as somehow tap or language itself, not just Latin, but language itself as tapping into the infinite, then every language, even if it's dead, in technical terms, really does give us a tool of expanding our minds and seeing the world the way that other people have seen the world. And after all, it's the same world.
Right. And I think this is the power of the liberal arts. These two main divisions, right? You have your trivium, the linguistic arts, And then you had the quadrivium, the mathematical arts. They're just woven into the fabric of the universe. And so as you were just talking about with math, right? The ancient world would have seen mathematical formulas, right? In creation, in nature. They see it everywhere. That their idea of music expands just beyond somebody playing, you know, their saxophone or their trumpet. But it's the harmony. So there's, I think it's Mercury and Venus are going like in a fifth, I believe it is, you know, the musical ratio that is just woven into nature, that these ratios, these harmonies, this ordering, it's just there. You don't have to use it. You don't have to exploit it. You enjoy it. You appreciate it. You discover it. And we can think about word the same way. So of course, from the Christian point of view, God speaks the universe into existence. He upholds it, right? By the word of his power?
Power of his word, something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there's a sense in which the universe is God's spoken word, and ongoing providence is him continuing to speak. And so when we're talking about the trivium or the quadrivium, we're tapping into the nature of reality.
It reminds me sort of the way that Tolkien writes about language, right? Like when Tolkien sits down to write Middle Earth, he doesn't start with, oh, this would be a nice story. I mean, as a philologist, as someone who is obsessed with words and their meanings and the way that they tap into the fabric of reality, Tolkien sits down and says, okay, if I want to create a mythical world, I have to start with language, right? Right. And I need words that don't just mean things, right? That aren't just nominal, right? We as a culture are very nominal. We think of things as, oh, the tree exists without the way that I think about it. And I just slap a label onto the tree and call it a tree, right? Tolkien, when he's writing Middle Earth, has a completely different understanding of both our reality and the reality he's writing. He looks at the world and says, no, like if I'm going to create a language, I need stories around each word, not just, you know, correlations between words and objects. No, like the words are intimately bound up with the story of that object. And I think that comes from his innate Christian understanding of the way that God created the world through words. And if we think about any language, whether it's Latin or Spanish or Japanese or Sanskrit, right? All of these things are tapping into the way that we as humans in our limited linguistic capacity can in some sense commune with God's creative power through the words that we use.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you know what Tolkien's game was, by the way?
No, I don't.
So he talked about this maybe in one of his lectures or one of his essays where he says, I love to find other players of the game. And I found somebody at a bar one time who was playing the game when all of a sudden he slammed his hand down and said, I will express the optative by means of the suffix. He's talking about inventing languages. And he just goes around and as Tolkien did,
wow,
basically playing with these things. But what you're saying with words aren't just these artificial constructs, signs, symbols that we make up and slap onto things, but there's a sense in which they're expressing or exposing something about reality. I mean, you kind of see this in Shakespeare, right? Would a rose by any other name smell as sweet? Like, can we make up another word for a rose and have it still be the same thing? Or are we just making up sounds and we slap them on? You know, we get out our label maker and we put it on different things in the universe. But we could just as easily rearrange the labels. There's nothing meaningful behind them.
Absolutely. Have you seen the movie Arrival?
I haven't.
Arrival, I think, is one of the few places in our just culturally where I've seen this idea really play out beautifully. So it's a film about, and I don't want to give away too much away for your sake, Austin, or for our listeners, but the premise of the film is these alien structures appear on Earth, and there's 12 of them, and no one really knows why they're there or how they got there. And the story is about this linguist who is hired by the United States military to try to decode the language of these aliens. And she starts working with this physicist, and some of their conversations are really fascinating. The physicist represents a slightly more nominal view of reality where, you know, he's looking for what's the objective truth here? How did the aliens travel faster than light? How did their ship appear? Why is there no radioactivity coming from their ship? Whereas the linguist is really trying to understand the way that these aliens are communicating. And suddenly she starts to actually interact with the fabric of reality because she's learning their language, right? Their language is a sort of more transcendent language in the film. And the thesis of the film really is that, one of the theses of the film, I think, is that, like, you know, learning a language that is more transcendent would actually make you be able to encounter reality in a more supernatural way. It's pretty fascinating.
Yeah. There's a sense in which we can only talk about or think about the things that we have language for. And I think this is connected. Right. So I think I saw in a, I don't remember if it was New York Times or some newspaper, right? The Eskimo language has something like 50 different words for snow. And when we have our one in English, snow, but yet we recognize there's a whole bunch of different types of snow. There's that really tight packing snow, the dense snow. There's the really light flaky snow. There's the snow that's bordering on rain. There's this, we have all these different kinds, but we only have the one word snow. And so there's the sense in which we're limited by how we can even think about it because we don't have the words to express these different things in reality.
And it's fascinating. I feel like that totally matches how most English-speaking people interact with snow. You know, if you're an Eskimo and you're interacting with all of these different kinds of snow, and like they're actually, you know, whether the lighter snow, whether it's lighter snow or sort of more frozen snow, like those, the way you think about snow in some sense is like bound up in your survival, right? Or in your everyday experience. And I don't know if there's even Eskimo poetry, but I could imagine like those different kinds of snow being really just poetic expressions of, you know, different shades of the same thing. And it's interesting, we do have similar areas of that in English. So I think a famous example is, you know, different words for food in English, right? So after the Battle of Hastings, the Normans take over England, and a lot of the French words sort of come to for animals come to represent prepared food, right? So beef, we think of as prepared cow, right? Cow that is cooked. That's the French word, comes from, I don't know what the root is, like boeuf or something, right? But that's how the Normans, that's how the aristocracy in that society would have encountered beef. Whereas the more Anglo-Saxon, the Anglo-Saxon class at that time, you know, they would have called the thing, oh, it's a cow, right? They experience cows as animals, not cows as food, a lot more. But then, you know, hundreds of years later, we have two different words, both coming from the same same idea, right? Cow. But one represents a kind of cow when it is prepared and cooked. The other represents a cow when you encounter it in the field, right? So actually what's fascinating is because English has so many of these, English as this language that's been boiled down from so many things, you know, Joseph Conrad, who one of my favorite poetic authors, he didn't write poetry, but just the way he thought was very poetic. When he was actually Polish, and he got done with his time as being part of the Polish Navy in the late 1890s and thought, okay, now I want to be a famous novelist. What language should I be a famous novelist in? So he learned German, French, and English. Those were the three languages he thought, these are the greatest novelistic languages. So he learned all three to try to decide which one he wanted to write in. And he actually settled on English because English, having come from so many other languages, had the most connotations, right? But even in English, as you were saying with the Eskimos, like there are pieces of the human experience that English speakers or the languages that made English what it is didn't necessarily encounter every day. And so, you know, regardless of what language you're learning, it's an opportunity to see the world in a different way. And I think one of the reasons that learning a dead language actually has so much merit to it is that no one really sees the world in this way anymore, right? It's one of the chief ways, I think, of exploring and actually understanding history, perhaps the most intimate level possible.
Right. Yeah, you're getting quite literally into their minds when you know their language. We've been talking generally about language and mostly vocabulary and words, right? The content that we speak about. But I think it's Marshall McLuhan's point here, or maybe Neil Postman kind of riffing off McLuhan, that technology not only changes what we think about, but it also changes how we think about it. So we talk about, you know, my hard drive is full or my memory is full, right? We're using almost these computer terms. My processing power is maxed out, right? We talk about human beings as in computeristic terms. So language changes what we can talk about based on the vocabulary. And Max was sharing the examples with French and English, but it also changes how we think about things, right? And the way we communicate it. And as we've been talking generally about language, I think this also helps us see why Latin remains such a potent force for thinking and viewing the world, because one, it's this ancient view, it's this medieval view, it's a view of the world that spans some, you know, almost what, 2000 years, more or less. But it's also a completely different way of picturing reality. I mean, so you can kind of think you go to your first year Spanish class and you might learn like, ¿dónde está el baño? Or something, right? Where's the bathroom? Or you learn how to order a beer. But when you're learning Latin, well, you're plunged into Cicero's Catiline orations or into Virgil's epic Aeneid. And the themes are much loftier. It changes what you have to think about, what kinds of questions are being raised, and you're learning how those ancient authors would have viewed them and being immersed in their culture. Which is, I think, something unique to, you know, Latin and Greek versus modern languages, just because they're further away from us.
It's interesting, too. So Alex Tocqueville, who wrote Democracy in America, he has this great chapter where he talks about why in a democracy, studying classical literature is especially important. And he sort of comes back to this idea that both in the early democracies and republics in ancient Greece and ancient Rome, everyone spoke those languages, but there was a much narrower percentage of the population that actually wrote in them, and that was typically the aristocracy. So whether it was political speeches or literature, it was people who, in some sense, had the leisure to think about those deeper things, right? So while in Latin, we're not necessarily teaching our students how to order a beer or how to ask where the bathroom is, right? That's not really the point. Like those are pieces that are, I think, common to every language to some degree. And so Tocqueville actually says that one of the reasons studying Latin and Greek in a democracy is so important is because it actually taps into those things that are easier to miss in a modern democracy, where everyone is literate, everyone has a voice, everyone has a bold voice, if I dare say, especially in our sort of Twitter era. So I'm going to read a quote from him. He says, referring to the aristocratic Roman writers, "If those writers sometimes lacked variety and imagination in their choice of subject, or boldness, energy, and the power of generalization in their ideas, they always exhibited admirable skill and care in the details. Nothing in their works seems hastily or haphazardly written, but is always aimed at the connoisseur and constantly seeks out an ideal of beauty. No other literature highlights more boldly than that of the ancients those qualities which are naturally missing from democratic writers. Therefore, no other literature is better suited for a society in democratic times," end quote.
Yeah, I think that's so right in our need of the day, right? We have particular blind spots that we fall into as a culture. In learning to see through the eyes of another culture, especially a distant culture, helps us see our own blind spots. We don't need as much correction where we're already strong and we just have a minor weakness. We need the correction where we're very weak, atrophied, and we need a large degree of improvement. We need something that we're not getting in our own culture. I mean, I think this is the strength of these dead languages, Greek and Latin, is that they are so far removed from us. I mean, French and Spanish, right? They're great languages in their own rights. There are many great works written in them, but they're very close to English still, right? They're very similar. You know, much in the same way that when learning English grammar, it's hard to learn if that's your native language because you speak it naturally. You don't have to think about it. There's no reflection there. You just kind of coast along and let the words pour out of your mouth without consciously reflecting. But when you pull it to such a foreign environment like Latin, now all of a sudden you have to start thinking about, okay, what is this doing in the sentence? What is the real meaning here? And then that process of trying to get it back into English, it just does wonders for your ability to think about language. I mean, Latin doesn't just have different vocabulary than English, but it has a whole different way of structuring sentences. I mean, you can compare them. Like the Latin sentences are almost like these ordered legions that they're in rows, and you have these long clauses. You don't just have one main verb. You don't just have them joined by conjunctions, but you have participles and you have these other, infinite verbs that are kind of hanging on. They're the subordinating clauses and they just pile up, and you have all these different ways of joining them together that we don't really do in English. We can't really replicate it. Instead, we end up converting everything to another finite verb. And joining in adverbial or subordinate clauses.
My Latin teacher in high school, she would always talk about, you know, in Latin, structure is everything, right? And she would always say, I mean, these are the people that built the aqueducts that are still standing, right? If we walk across Europe and are walking roads that the Romans built and looking up at these structures that the Romans built that are still standing, like we wouldn't expect anything else, right? Than a language that is structured so carefully and has such an emphasis on detail and how actually there's a variability in word order in Latin that we don't have in English. That also opens this door for like added drama, right? So one of my Latin students, so in Latin, often you'll have, at least in sort of the most basic sentence, you'll have the verb at the end, and then you'll have sort of your subject or some main clauses at the beginning. And often my students were like, well, how do you know what's happening in the sentence until you read the very end? And I said, that's the point, right? Like that's part of the drama of the Roman sentence, right? There's a clear introduction of here are the characters and here are the important details in the clauses about the characters, right? And imagine, right, you don't know what these characters are doing. You find out who they're doing them to before you find out the verb, what they're doing until the very end of the sentence. Now imagine if you're hearing a sentence or hearing a story that's being told by a sentence in Latin for the first time, and you have to wait till the very last word to get the verb. Like, imagine what that does to the suspension of the story that sentence is telling. And I remember I told them this and they were like, whoa. And I said, this is why it's really important when we're reading our Latin sentences, not to just translate them. We have to think them, right? We have to read the sentence enough times so that we can understand what the sentence is saying in Latin. And that's really hard to do in a dead language when, you know, our fallback is just English, you know, especially when Latin is the first non-English language a lot of these students are learning. But that's where the real work and the beauty of the language comes in.
Yeah, it's wholly different than ours. And so it communicates things that ours can't. And I think, again, because of it, that's such detailed structure, it communicates things that modern languages really don't. I mean, our modern languages, as we've been reflecting, tend to reflect our mind, right? They're sloppy, they're unorganized, they're usually short, punchy, can scatter around. But Latin, you can have these almost paragraphs in themselves, sentences, because they have that way of regimenting. Mm-hmm. As you're talking about waiting till the end, I was sent scurrying for one of my Latin books for an epigram of Martial's, where he kind of does this. He's writing to, let's see, Cecilianus, and he's writing about his books, and Cecilianus will read an epigram or poem of Martial, and then I'll read somebody else. And Martial basically says, oh, you're doing this so that you can show that mine are better. And it's like, yeah, that's great. But then he gets to the punchline, which is the very end, right? Malo tamen recites, Ceciliana, tua. And he waits till the very end to say, I wish you would rather recite yours, and then you'd really make me look good. But it's he does this frequently in his epigrams, where he holds off to the very end to give that final word that changes everything about the epigram, the poem.
Oh man, that's amazing.
I want to say there's another one. I might not be able to find it, but I think he puts, I think it's the word nose at the very end. I can't remember the exact context, but it's kind of a similar sort of thing.
Yeah, it's in looking especially, and I haven't done so. For our listeners, Latin or Austin teaches the sort of higher end Latin at our school. I teach the sort of middling Latin. So Austin's like advanced Latin skills are a lot sharper than mine. But I remember it's been so long since I've read Horace, but in reading Horace, being struck by, because the word order is so variable, right? And so often there are these twists at the very end, right? You can read a whole poem and be getting specific phrases that in English you would have to have in certain places of the sentence, but that again, like are held, like the meat of what the poet is saying is often held for the very end. So you can be reading. So I'm thinking of Horace's poem Fons Bunduzii, right, where he's talking about this beautiful stream and how, oh yeah, the animals are next to the stream, and then at the very end he starts talking about the bloody sacrificial Roman system and how this water is poisoned with the blood of these animals. And he starts weaving in those sorts of ideas about blood in the beginning of the poem, but you don't really understand why they're there until that punchline at the very end, where he really smacks you over the head and says, yeah, look at this twist. I took something beautiful and now I'm showing you the sort of dark underbelly of it. Really, really amazing.
So we've been talking a lot about how great Latin is and, you know, some of the effects that it can produce. But perhaps the objection is raised, well, why can't other languages do this same thing? So I was in Turkey for a number of weeks, was trying to learn Turkish while I was there, and they do the same thing. The verb comes at the very end. So Cicero can use this to great effect in his orations where he holds that final verb to the end, but Turkish can also do the same thing. So why Latin and not something like French or Spanish or, you know, Mandarin, if each language kind of has its own unique benefits, its own unique ways of looking at the world, why isn't one of these modern languages any worse or any better than Latin?
Yeah, and there I think I would say sort of what we've already said about how there's a removal in time that is really, really important. So Lewis talks about, and this connects to our Tocqueville quote, right? He says, FDR and Hitler, even though they're, you know, fighting the same war with each other, they're actually more of the same mind than, you know, FDR and Augustine would have been, right? Even though FDR and Augustine both seem to be on the good guy side of history, there's a time removal there that actually makes them really, really different. And that's where I think Latin as a historical language, as a language that isn't changing anymore and sort of has locked certain assumptions about the world and of the past into its even its grammatical structure, makes it different than, you know, learning Turkish or Mandarin, simply because by merit of the fact that those languages are still alive right now and changing and evolving.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think I return to, you know, these ideas of content and structure, in that Latin language affects what you think about. And because the best of Latin literature has survived, if you're reading Latin literature, you tend to be thinking about the best things. We want to think about what is most beautiful, what is most true, what is most good. And if you're reading great literature that has survived thousands of years, that wasn't consumed in a fire, well, you're probably reading about the best things. Whereas if we're doing modern languages, although of course there are, you know, Don Quixote and you have Montesquieu and Voltaire and you have all these things, modern language classes tend to be taught about more trivial things. And you know, again, that's not to knock the languages, but it's just the focus. They're different focuses, being a classical language versus a modern language. Then also the structure of it. Again, Latin, I think, has an ability to order your mind in a way that, you know, I don't know that there's a comparable modern language that does that. Part of that's just because it's foreign. Part of that's just because of the nature of the Romans and how they saw the world, spoke about the world. And we can gain those benefits in Latin and apply them to our own English prose. Mm-hmm. I've been trying to track down a quote, but I haven't been able to find it. I know I read it somewhere, but it was an author who, I believe he was a German author. And so he would first write in Latin for clarity. And then I think he would translate into either French or Italian or something for style. And then I think finally he would go into his own native language.
Wow. Fast.
You know, sometimes students get upset that they have to do English to Latin translations. And they're like, oh, what's the use of this? Why do I have to do this? But it forces you to think, what is actually being communicated here at the most fundamental level? And how do I transfer that over? But that also works the other way too.
Yeah.
Like what, I mean, this is why it's not just grammar that Latin helps with, but also logic and rhetoric. Because what is the nature of reality and how do I express that in thought and speech? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think into Latin translations are some of the most vital, important parts. And I think that's the reason it's the hardest, right? That's the work that our minds has to stretch the most in order to actually encounter Latin as something other, right? And that's something I love doing even by myself when I'm practicing Latin is, you know, I'll have the textbook and I'll see the sentence in English and I'll try to just speak out verbally without even writing it out. You know, how would a Roman think about this, right? How do I, in my mind, think about, you know, how the clauses are arranged? And it really stretches you, but it's really fun. I was at a bookstore actually the other day, and I found this like 1889 Latin textbook that was all Latin composition. So it was like, you know, advanced Latin textbook, and basically it had the English translations. Every exercise was an English translation of a famous Roman speech. And the exercises were you translating that into Latin. And then in the back of the book were the actual Roman speeches, and you would see how close that you got. And I didn't buy it, but ever since I saw that, I've been kicking myself. It's like, oh, yeah. If I could work up to that, that would be so hard and so good for the way that I think about the world.
Yeah. Yeah. And they were doing that not because they thought that their, you know, the world leaders or the aristocrats in 1889 were writing Latin letters or, you know, writing treaties in Latin. but because they saw how it could order their mind so that they could communicate more clearly in whatever language they were using.
Yeah.
Latin. They saw it as a necessary thing.
Yeah. It's such an analytical tool that just you don't find in a lot of other places.
Yeah. So I have another quote here that I think is getting to this, and then maybe we'll jump to the second reason for studying Latin. But the quote is, Mr. Shorey of Chicago lays his finger on the point when he says, "I am cynically skeptical about students who cannot understand elementary Latin syntax, but distinguish themselves in mathematics, exact science, or political economy. The student who is really baffled by the elementary logical analysis of language may be a keen observer, a deft mathematician, an artistic genius. He will never be an analytical thinker." I mean, those pretty strong words. That if you can't understand elementary Latin syntax, there's a sense in which there's a deficiency in your mind of comprehending part of the world. You're very good in other areas of the world, but there's a sense in which your linguistic faculties, your analytical faculties are weakened.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. All right, shall we move on to our second
jump ahead.
Reason?
Yeah. Yeah, so secondary reasons for studying Latin. And these are the ones that get the most press, I think. Max was talking earlier about the historical connection with English. So if we think about the history of the English language, so the Romans travel across to Britain, right, during the days of Julius Caesar, during the days of Claudius. They sort of retreat under Hadrian. And the Germanic tribes, there's the Picts, there's the Celts, the Angles, and the Saxons come over at a later date. You already have this mixing of the language, but it's fundamentally Germanic. There's a lot of connections between those various groups. Well, in 1066, right, William the Conqueror from the French territory, Normandy, travels across the English Channel, beats back the Angles and the Saxons. But then they say, hey, it's kind of nice here. Let's settle down. And so they start intermarrying. And so you have these French nobles marrying with the Germanic tribes, producing children, and they're essentially bilingual. And so he was mentioning that you have this. You have these two different words based on whether they're the aristocratic class coming from the French or whether they're kind of the poorer farmer class with the Germanic languages. So you have cow and beef, chicken and poultry, pig and pork, deer and venison, right? It goes on and on. That in the language, you have the history of these two streams merging together. And so English, almost in that, has the fusing of Germanic words. It has French words. It has Latin words through the French. It also brings in Greek words, and you have this big melting pot that's demonstrating the history of English development. Mm-hmm. So by studying Latin, you are better able to understand English words that we use because you can trace their history. You can get out the family tree, the genealogy, and go back to see where these different words came from. I think one of my favorite derivatives is defenestrate.
Oh, yes.
Defenestrate. So, right, day, down from, concerning about, fenestro, right, from
window.
A window. Yeah, window. So defenestrate, toss somebody out a window. And
one of my favorite experiences with that word, I played this game of Bananagrams when I was on a dinosaur dig in Montana. That's a long story. But I flipped over my tiles and I literally had the letters to spell defenestration. And I put it all together and I went, I don't even need to win anymore. Yeah. yeah, I think one of my favorite derivatives is ambulacra. So okay. Ambulacra, to walk. And I can't remember actually where cra or crum, what that one means. But in ancient Rome, an ambulacra was often like a colonnade. It was like a path between two columns that you would walk down, right? It's sort of like where the Romans would picnic. And what this has actually come to mean is the rows of suckers on the bottom of a starfish. Because when scientists started flipping over starfish and looking at them, they said, hey, this looks like a colonnade, right? So they named it after the Roman term for, a colonnade that you walk down.
Yeah, perfect. I think there's a lot of examples of that. So oftentimes when people want to convince others of the merits of Latin, they'll point to these different specific fields, medicine. So medical terminology, much of it comes from Latin. You have scientific terminology that comes from Latin. You have politics and economics and theology, and you have all these different areas that trace their roots back to the language where, I suppose the first principles are being laid down or explored. And so they, carrying on the tradition, just keep using the same words.
Mm-hmm. So you, I have a question for you. When did you actually start learning Latin?
Yeah, let's go ahead and take the detour, I suppose. So I didn't learn Latin until I started teaching it. In college, I had a few years of Greek. When I got associated with Caris, began teaching, they were asking me, hey, how do you feel about teaching Latin? So sure. So first year teaching, without having any Latin experience, I dove in. I taught I think it was fourth grade, a Latin class, Latin B. And so I dove right in. It's like, okay, yeah, this is similar to Greek with the declension systems. I think the next year I taught the second half of the book, Latin for Children B, with the fifth graders. I think the following year I started teaching it would have been eighth or ninth grade, the Latin Alive series, working through that. And I'm still trying to stay one chapter ahead. And I think it was after that maybe second or third year of teaching Latin, I discovered the Lingua Latina series. I don't know if you've heard of it.
Yeah.
But essentially it's a method of teaching Latin strictly through Latin stories. So the entire book is in Latin. Any definitions of words are defined through pictures or through other Latin words that you've already learned. And so it's a very immersive approach. So I worked through that first book and that really took off or sped up my Latin learning. And then I've taught a few more years since then, taught a few more Latin Alive books, jumped over to Wheelox, and just trying to find new reading material to gain ability. Like, I'm still not able to pick up a completely original text and work through it without any helps. But if you have something like, Clyde Farr's edition of the Aeneid, I think it's Clyde Farr's, where he's giving you vocabulary that's used fewer than 15 times or 10 times or something, and some grammatical helps, I can work through with a little bit of difficulty.
Yeah. So thinking about Latin in connection to English, you already had a very well-established connection to your native language, English. You learned Latin sort of as an adult. Were there specific things that you saw in learning Latin that like you could, as you were doing it, articulate that helped you with English or made you see English differently maybe?
Yeah. So I guess in Latin, I think the thing that I come back to all the time are participles and thinking about the relation to these other clauses to the main clause in the sentence. So with Latin participles, oftentimes you'll have what's called an ablative absolute at the beginning of the sentence. Yeah, Max is cheering. So you have a noun and a participle. And these, kind of the blunt way of translating them is just the very rigid, right? Having been conquered, having been farmed, having been raised, having been put to death, right? Speaking of language and words that they have, Latin has so many words for killing or putting to death or butchering and so on. Caesar can describe the same events over and over again with using a different word each time. But anyways, what's really going on though is that there's often an association of time. And so you're thinking, is this a temporal use? Like when this happened, then this next thing happened. Or is it a cause and effect? Because this thing happened, the next thing happened. Is it concession that although these events happened, this other thing still happened? And looking at it in Latin and thinking about all those different possible relationships makes me look at English in the same way. So when I see a subordinate clause, although we have perhaps more specific conjunctions to indicate these relationships, we tend to just gloss over them and not really think about what does it really mean though? When this happened, although, since, because, so, for, and so on, with the result that we don't really have to think about it consciously. But learning Latin helped me to start reflecting on those kinds of things more consciously. Sure. How about you? Do you have an example of Latin changing the way you think about English language?
So I learned Latin when I was in like middle school, high school. And I think the biggest things, I never had a good English grammar education. So even just the basics of English grammar, I think of in terms of Latin. And I often think of in terms of not necessarily the case system, but the things that the case system in Latin, the declension system gives us. And I think the biggest thing, is thinking about the drama of a sentence, right? As we already talked about, how does word order change a sentence? That's probably the biggest thing.
Yeah. Since you mentioned it, that's another thing that I was actually helped by with Latin. That is forever solved for me. The who, whom, I, me, he, him, which one, subject or object? Well, he is, he, I, who, they're all the subjective cases. Yep. So anywhere it would be the subject, you use that one. Anywhere it would be the object, you use, him, whom, me, and so on. And so that's forever solved it for me, right? After prepositions, beginning of sentences, right? Thinking about it in Latin, nominative versus accusative case. It's like, that's fixed it.
Yeah. I always tell my students, like, whenever we do the first person personal pronouns, right? Ego me, mihi me, me. I'm always like, from now on, whenever someone knocks at the door and asks, you know, and you ask who it is, or whenever you're knocking at the door and someone asks who it is, you have to say, it is I, not it's me.
Right.
It sounds
right.
Very dramatic. And it sounds like you should be wearing a cape, but technically it is I.
Yeah. So Latin helps with grammar, as we've been discussing. It helps your English grammar, your English syntax. There are practical benefits to Latin. It also helps with vocabulary, as we mentioned. There's also studies that seem to correlate Latin study with higher SAT scores and ACT scores. You know, if that's your thing, like, sure. I don't know how you can prove the causation of that, but there seems to be a very strong correlation, which makes it, you know, probable that there's some connection there. We talked about the history of English as well. But I think another benefit of Latin is just that it helps you understand classical culture, right? It's a great education in the history, the life of Greece and Rome, which are the classical cultures, which are the ones that we are holding up as examples of virtue and wisdom that we can adapt for the modern world.
Yeah. I think one of my favorite things in teaching Latin is like all of the funny little nitpicky details that you pick up about the culture of ancient Rome or Greece, mm-hmm. right? Like, I love talking about garum, this weird fish sauce that, you know, the Romans would make out of like fermented fish. And apparently, like, in Pompeii, you know, every other, if you like look at what the ruins were, like, every other storefront is a garum shop, right? It's like if we were so obsessed with ketchup that you walk into a strip mall and every other booth is a ketchup store, you know? So it doesn't have to be like, absolutely, we can retain a lot of things about how did the Romans think about love or honor, right? But also the little sort of more trivial details are just a lot of fun.
Yeah. Yeah. That's all I had for practical reasons. Did you have any other kind of the practical, here's the main application of learning Latin?
Yeah, I think the big practical application that I always heard growing up was it makes Romance languages a lot easier to learn, right?
Right.
So French, Italian, Portuguese, Spanish. I feel like there's one more, but maybe that's it.
French, Italian, Portuguese, Spanish.
I think it's just four.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Like, you know, learning those, it makes learning those a lot easier. And, you know, if you do want to be a doctor, learning your Latin roots and your Greek roots, it'll help you with figuring out words that you might not otherwise have known. Those are the big other ones.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think there's truth to that, right? I think it would help going into Romance languages because there is a even more direct connection to Latin.
Yeah.
Right. We get our Latin and English through French, whereas French gets it more directly, and same with Italian and Spanish. So I think Dorothy Sayers famously, you know, taught herself Italian because she had some Latin experience and then goes on to translate, you know, the Divine Comedy, or at least most of it. But I think these reasons are somewhat weak, right? I mean, we could say for all of these different practical benefits, well, you know, I think as you've put it, you're essentially saying, well, learn Latin so you can learn other stuff. Well, you could just directly learn the other stuff, mm-hmm. right? You could get a book of Latin roots if that's what you want to study. You could get an SAT prep book. You could just learn the Romance language directly or learn another Romance language, which would help you learn, you know, one of its sister languages. You know, just learn about classical culture, right? There's all these other more direct routes to get to those practical benefits. You know, so while I think Latin helps in all those things, I think there's greater reasons for studying Latin, and it has to do with Latin as a language itself. So perhaps the strongest case I would try to make is simply that Latin, because of its content, because of its style, right, is in itself a beautiful language that deserves to be studied and appreciated and loved. And this goes back to, so while this is true of every language, Latin itself, in the sheer time that it has endured, testifies to its greatness.
Yeah. So I think the clearest example that I've had of the power of Latin was this absolutely transcendent experience I had in college. So I had had some Latin in high school, and I passed into in college only needing to take one class for my language requirement in Latin. And it was just a Latin reading class, right? So all of the grammar I'd already had, And so we just sat down with the Wheelock's reader and a couple other texts, and we just read. And we, what was interesting is my teacher in high school really didn't focus on pronunciation all that much. And so I didn't have a very clear idea of, you know, what are long syllables? What are stressed syllables? How do they make a difference when you're, you know, when you're reading something in Latin? Because it just wasn't focused on. And we did poetry, but we got to that unit in my college class on Latin poetry. And my professor, Dr. Alex Loney at Wheaton College, he opened up the book and he read the beginning of Icarus and Daedalus from Ovid's Metamorphosis. And it was like hearing music for the first time. Like, I will never forget being rooted to my seat, just hearing the language and the rhythm and the meter of the syllables wash over me in a way that I had never encountered before. I mean, imagine you've never heard music before and you suddenly hear, you know, your favorite song, right? Or something like that. That's what it was like. And from that moment, like, I thought I loved Latin before, but that was the moment where I was like, whoa, everyone, I want everyone to experience this.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's, I mean, that's what I want to communicate, right? Latin in itself is a beautiful language. You don't need it for any other practical benefit. You don't ask, oh, why do I have that painting in my house? How much money is that earning me, right? You enjoy it. You wonder at it. Like, there is so many things in the world that we don't need to do anything with. We just enjoy them. And Latin is one of those things. So let's talk a little bit about Latin poetry. So Dactylic Hexameter, right? That Ovid's writing in. That Virgil's writing in, and then I'll try and give an example.
Yeah, great. So, So most Latin poetry is in dactylic hexameter. So there's a lot of different metric feet. This is probably a whole nother podcast on poetry, but if you want to understand what a dactyl is, I want all of our listeners, unless you're driving, hold out your pointer finger. Yeah. And so dactyl is the Latin or the Greek word for finger, right? Pterodactyl means wing finger. Hold out your pointer finger, and if you look at it, if you're looking at your left pointer finger, you've got a long digit and then two short digits, right? Long, short, short. That's what a dactyl is. So a dactylic, any dactylic foot is a da-da-da, right? Da-da-da, long, short, short. And then if we add that to a certain number of feet, right? Hexameter, hex means six in Greek. So dactylic hexameter is poetry that is composed of lines of poetry that are made of dactyls, da da da, and there are six of those. So an example would be da 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 da, right? Six da da das. So Lawson, do you have an example in Latin?
Yes, I do. Yeah. So this is from Virgil's Aeneid. So you're gonna get the sense of almost this galloping pace of it, where right, it's an epic poem and it kind of moves along very quickly. You have, I think they're sometimes called heartbeats and hoofbeats, where you have the dactyl, as Max was talking about, and then the spondee.
Oh, the spondee.
So long, yes. long. Yep, long. And so in English poetry, we tend to move by accent. So da, 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 right? Where you accent it. In Latin poetry, it's length.
Yeah.
And so how long you're, which is very difficult to do for an English speaker that hasn't really heard this.
Hard. Yes.
All right. Yeah. All right. So here's Virgil's Aeneid. Arma virumque cano Troiae qui primis aboris, Italiam fato profagis lawina que venet litera, multil et teris jactatis et alto, vi supram saevae memorem unonis abirum, multa quoquet bello passus. Dum conderet urbem in ferretque de os Latio, genus unde Latinam albanisque patres at qualtae moenia Romae. Musa mihi causas memora quo numera laeso, quid videlens regina de tot vovra casus. Insignem pietatem virum totodire labores impulerit. Tantae nanimis caelestibus irae. So I think that's the first 12 lines or so of the Aeneid. And you kind of have the galloping dactyl. Arma virum quae cano, right? And then you also have the spondees too, the da da, kind of changing in pace.
And learn those rules of, you know, when a spondee can be there and when it replaces a dactyl, and how the lengths of those syllables sort of add up in certain ways, is something that I'm still really working towards figuring out. But that's what makes that's what makes it so compelling, right? Like, just the difference between the galloping, and it's almost like the horse leaps up on the spondees and then it crashes back down and keeps galloping on the on the dactyls. Oh,
what makes it also so fun is when you start doing the accents too, because the accents don't always fall on the first syllable of a foot as they would in, typically in English. So in English, right, you know, something like Shakespeare writing in iambs, the accent's always on the stressed syllable. So like to be or not to be, that is the question, right? It can be very sing-songy. Mm-hmm. What often happens in Latin is that the way you would read the word gets accented off the beat. Mm-hmm. And so you almost have this syncopated effect going on, which just makes it so much more dynamic as opposed to the, you know, just straight meter. Da 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 da. Right, it can be again kind of sing-songy, but yeah, it's a lot of fun. Oh. But the thing about it, and I think this is true of all poetry, is you can't really translate it. I mean, there's very good English translations of the Aeneid, but they don't really capture that same feel and emotion and drive that Virgil's composition in Latin does. It's a different feel. Like, I mean, translations are great. They can be, you know, great to read, great to enjoy. They're often works of art in their own right. You know, you can think of Alexander Pope, his iambic, I think pentameter translation of the Odyssey. Right? They're great in their own right, but they're not the same. They're different, and we lose some of that when we go into a different language.
Yeah, absolutely. I love thinking about this too in terms of church liturgy. So not only is Latin the language of the ancient Romans, but it's also the language of the historic Western church. And so something that I do pretty much all semester long with my students is, you know, we memorize the Lord's Prayer in Latin, the Sanctus, and the Agnus Dei, just these key pieces of the historic prayers of the church. And that's another great way, I think, of, you know, encountering Latin and encountering both another culture, but also, you know, as believers, the cloud of witnesses in a sense, right? Being able to worship using the same words, not just the same meanings, but the same words as believers that have been worshiping, you know, from the first century is just really, it's really powerful.
Yeah, I think we tend to downplay that in our modern age, right? As we've been talking about, like, do the words really matter? I mean, we can just take the meaning and we can put it into a different form. But I would, you know, argue that the form of something matters very much, right? The actual pattern and the words matters for its meaning. So, I mean, it's the same thing with poetry. You can read a poem and then have somebody explain what it means, but you've changed it. Like, although you might have part of the meaning, it's still something different. And so when we're changing the words, even though it might be a very good and close translation, it's still a different meaning. Mm-hmm. And I think Latin, as a great language for the church, for classical culture, for prayers, for songs, for theology, right? You are being connected to, you know, the church through all ages in embracing this same language. So I know I sent it to you at one point. I forget who said it, but essentially Latin and Greek are the languages the bride has sung to the groom in the most, right? And, and that's why you learn Latin or you learn Greek, right? So I guess we can close off with one final question, right? If you're still on the fence, maybe you can think about it this way, right? Were the Renaissance and the Reformation good things, right? So you know, if you're not a Protestant, you might not look at the Reformation as favorably, but you can certainly pick out the Renaissance, right? In both of these things, what's going on is that they are not just rediscovering works of antiquity. It's not just that Aristotle got imported. It's not just that Plato got, you know, re-imported back into the West. It's not just that, you know, and Martin Luther and John Calvin and so on started reading the church fathers, but it's that there's a revival of the classical languages of antiquity that really drive these two movements. That it's not just the sources themselves, but the languages that the sources are written in. They're not just dabbling in translations, but they're going back to the fountain, right? Ad fontes. This is the cry of the Renaissance, that they want to learn and prize these languages above all and revive them. And, you know, just look at the fruit, right? Look at what came of it. Mm-hmm. So I don't think we can downplay the languages themselves and say, well, we can just do it with the translations. Right? Mm-hmm. I think there's a closer connection of the works themselves to the languages than we sometimes give credit for.
Yeah. And I think it's really important too, in just thinking about the history of the Latin language, right? We tend to think, oh, it's the Greeks and the Romans, or it's the language of the Catholic Church. But I think it's really important too to remember that there's a lot of post-Renaissance and post-Reformation Latin that's going on too. You know, Isaac Newton himself is writing his, you know, laws of gravity in Latin. And that's something that I think we really forget too. Like, it's the language of science. It's the language of, you know, it's post-Reformation as much and Renaissance as much as it's pre-Renaissance and Reformation.
Yeah. I mean, I think it was until something like maybe the 1920s that, you know, the great German research universities were requiring students to go through the gymnasia or go through Latin before admits. I mean, you can look at, you know, ministry. I think after Latin and Greek stopped being required as graduation requirements, we can see kind of a decline in church health, both in theology, but also liturgy and practice. Right? And I think there's a close connection there. We tend to overlook that. We say, yeah, you know, language, what, you know, we're nominalists. We're in a nominalist age, but language is important. So learn Latin. Well, thank you for joining us for another episode of Handmade Humanity. Glad you listened. If you enjoyed the show, please consider sharing with some of your friends or someone that you think might be interested in it. We'd love to continue doing this, producing these different shows, and hopefully exposing you to good, great, and beautiful things in the classical tradition. There's so much to explore there. We want to encourage you to take up and read for yourself. So please join us again next week for another episode of Handmade Humanity.